The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Now, I hope all of our listeners had a nice, relaxing, peaceful day of rage yesterday. That's what hard left activists had called for in Britain. Definitely much talked about this day of rage. One of the main groups behind this was a Marxist group called the Movement for Justice by Any Means Necessary. They wrote that after the election, we felt our power. We've tasted victory. Now we must escalate our actions to take down this rotten government, which has lost all authority to govern. It's a war, one activist said. It's rich against poor right now. So that's behind this day of rage. Just read a few more quotes from them about what they wanted to do with this big protest against the government. This movement for justice by any means necessary. They said that the authorities, the government, was conducting ethnic cleansing. They said that MPs had seized power through racism. One of their posters said, this government has presided over thousands of deaths from 7 years of austerity and anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant racism and bigotry. They need to go now. In the end, this day of rage actually ended up turning out a bit of a joke. Only a few hundred really hardcore demonstrators ended up standing up. This is Britain. Maybe they would have gotten a better response if they'd called it a day of being mildly peeved. I don't know, a day of passive-aggressive disapproval perhaps would have generated more of a following. But don't let that small response from the actual public and how they responded to these activists, don't let that make you overlook what is happening here. There's a core of left-wing activists in Britain. The same core is now at the top of the Labour Party, and they want to jump on any grievance to do anything they can to stir up rage, anger against the government, to encourage people to come out and shut down the government, to take down this rotten government, as the organisers of this day said. Now, behind this day of rage was the Grenfell Tower disaster that we even heard a little bit more about at the top of the hour news in the run-up to this programme. And that really was a disaster. It looks like the death toll from this tower, this apartment block in London burning down will be more than 80. And that's a big number. That is more than the 3 terrorist attacks that we've seen very recently. And so people are shocked and unhappy, obviously. But the left has really jumped on this as an opportunity to try and stir people against the government. You see them with all kinds of slogans like the government has blood on their hands. Calling for war, as we read from some of those quotes. On Friday, we saw a very good metaphor for what is happening here, when a bunch of angry demonstrators stormed the local government offices, and they found someone wearing a suit who looked kind of important. Some reports say that they thought he was the head of the local council, but anyway, they attacked him. And it turned out he was completely innocent. He had nothing to do with running the local government. And in fact, he had spent much of the week volunteering to help those made homeless by the fire. But there are people there just trying to stir up anger. And they're looking for a target. Now, I said it was a good metaphor, but not quite a perfect metaphor, because people attacking the government now, it's not a part of just an accidental, mistaken identity. They're being... There are people on the left deliberately trying to stir people against the government, deliberately trying to attack the government. Really, there are all kinds of much better people to accuse or to, I mean, obviously not attack, but to look at their culpability in this. Some have been talking about how actually you should look at the previous Labour government because this was a government, or it was kind of a government-owned set of apartment blocks here, so that people were renting these apartments at a much lower rate from the local authority, from the local government. And Labour, when they were in charge, they had a scheme to try and improve the look of these government houses like Grenfell Towers. And they didn't necessarily, you know, they were most concerned about making it look nice. And so people are saying, some are saying, well, actually, you should put the blame on them for being overly focused on that. I think there's a very strong case that the anger would be much better directed at the European Union. There are a lot of people out there attacking the government, saying that, well, the government set building standards too lax because basically they don't care about poor people who live in these high-rise buildings, when actually the UK government has no power to set building standards. In 1989, the European Union took over power to set building standards. EU member nations like the UK, because the UK is still currently part of the European Union until they've finished this exit process. But the UK no longer has the authority to set its own building regulations. Now, there are some countries like Germany that have tighter building regulations, but the only reason they have those tighter ones is because they were already in place before 1989. The UK cannot tighten up fire safety regulations until it's outside of the European Union. And then, kind of compounding the guilt of the EU, in 2012, the EU released another directive, and this directive said that when local governments renovate buildings, the top priority must be energy efficiency. That was an EU diktat, and so they were encouraging, you know, they said that was the top priority, and the local government followed through with that. The material they used in building this building, yes, it was very flammable, but it was also very good at keeping the heat in. And they were just following exactly what the EU directives told them to do. So, you know, if you were looking at it just rationally, the EU would probably be a much better target for all this anger than the Conservative government. But to be completely fair, it's too early to say. There's going to be an inquiry. It hasn't happened yet. There's still different things coming out over the facts. Like I said, at the top of the hour news today, we just heard a bit more about how actually some of these people might have died because of the fumes given off by this specific material as it burned. And that might play a bigger role in the problem than necessarily things like getting out of the building quickly. So we don't have all the facts yet. But that's not stopping the radical left trying to incite rage against the government. Melanie Phillips had an article on exactly this subject in the Times on Monday, and she wrote, "When a terrible catastrophe happens, which is bound to provoke enormous public anger, the immediate response for all in authority should be above all to calm people down. The situation can otherwise spiral dangerously out of control into disorder and violence. Further inciting that anger is therefore the height of political irresponsibility or worse. Yet that is precisely what has been happening in the aftermath of the inferno that consumed Grenfell Tower." And she did talk about how, yes, there are quite a few things the government probably could have done better in its response. And there were things that weren't necessarily the best handled, or, you know, from a PR point of view, weren't the best either. But then she goes on, "Yet the fire is being exploited in a sectarian and cynical way to fuel public anger and provoke disorder. Those being unjustly damned for causing the disaster are the Tory government and the rich. In other words, it's class war." And we already read some of the placards saying exactly that. "These protests are being fomented by professional agitators. You only have to look at the quality of the socialist workers' posters reading Tories have blood on their hands to realise these are not spontaneous eruptions of public anger. Not spontaneous eruptions of public anger. The Grenfell tragedy is being appropriated as part of a broader and more sinister political strategy. On Saturday, there were further protests across the UK with activists waving placards saying, 'Defy Tory rule.' See, this is all about professional left-wing socialist agitators trying to stir people against the government, to defy the government, to overthrow the government." Going back to Melanie Phillips, she writes, "What's happening is an attempt to stir insurrection on the streets against the democratically elected Westminster government. Labour's Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell has called for 1 million people to take to the streets on Saturday to force Theresa May from power. And there are more demonstrations coming up." She goes on to quote, or play some of the quotes she reads from Jeremy Corbyn, but she quotes from Jeremy, we'll go on and play some of the quotes from John McDonnell. She also quotes Jeremy Corbyn In 2015, he said the Tories should be in no doubt. We will use the surge in excitement about progressive politics to pursue them at every turn. Pursue them at every turn. Focus our energies on massive growth in campaigning politics. And she's absolutely right that those at the top of the Labour Party are supporting this. They're behind this. They're encouraging this anger. And they're trying to use it to push people to the left. Jeremy Corbyn, he called for people, for the government to confiscate homes from the rich in London to give to people who have lost theirs. We'll play that clip for you now.
There are a large number of deliberately kept vacant flats and properties all over London. It's called land banking. People with a lot of money buy a house, buy a flat, keep it empty.
But you would seize it forever or just take it for as long as they're needed? I'm just looking at the mechanism.
Occupy it, compulsory purchase it, requisition it. There's a lot of things you can do. But can't we as a society just think, all of us? It's all very well putting our arms around people during the crisis, but homelessness is rising, the housing crisis is getting worse. And my point was quite a simple one. In an emergency, you have to bring all assets to the table in order to deal with that crisis. And that is what I think we should be doing in this case.
I think it's being disingenuous when talking about how big of a deal land banking actually is. I think I saw some statistics on that earlier in the week. But look again what he's doing here. It's a radical proposal, confiscating houses from the rich. It's the type of thing that normally would be completely thrown out. It's a bit like what they did in Zimbabwe, what they're doing in South Africa, just forcefully taking farms off white farmers. Secure property rights, that's an absolutely crucial part of the rule of law. That if you own something, you own it, and nobody else can take it away from you. And maybe there are times, like times of war, for example, where it's essential for national survival. But here, there are countless other ways for the government to house people from this tower. And in fact, they found countless other ways. They just bought a whole bunch of luxury apartments that are just down the road, and they're going to move everybody in there. So it doesn't require. It's not the kind of emergency that you would need to even begin to talk about that kind of thing. And this kind of, you know, confiscation of property absolutely destroys an economy. Because with that, there's no incentive to invest in the long term if you know the government might just take it off you. But he chose this issue where people are emotional, where there is a lot of emotional resonance here, a lot of sadness, obviously. And he's using this to try and shift people over to the left, to bring people over to the left, towards these radical socialist policies, like confiscating houses from the rich. Separately, I think he wrote, Kensington is a tale of two cities. The south part of Kensington is incredibly wealthy. It's the wealthiest part of the whole country. The ward where this fire took place is, I think, the poorest ward in the whole country. And properties must be found, requisitioned if necessary. So he's trying to make this an issue of rich against poor. It can't be acceptable, he said, that in London we have luxury buildings and luxury flats left empty as land banking for the future while the homeless and the poor look for somewhere to live. We have to address these issues. So he's trying to stir up this anger, but perhaps the most surprising thing is that it's so popular. 59% in one survey, 59% said that they supported Jeremy Corbyn on this, that they wanted to take houses from the rich. Only 28% said that they opposed. So he's trying to use this to bring people to promote popularity of these radical proposals. John McDonnell, kind of his number two, the Labour's shadow chancellor, he's also behind all this kind of thing. He's been at the headline speaker at one of this Movement for Justice by Any Means Necessary group's events in the past. You know, he knows all of their organisers. That's all part of his social circle. And here's what he was said on the radio about this day of rage.
I put it to you that you sound very reasonable when you come on the radio. You talk to the Morning Star and you say to people who are at the moment preparing for what's called a day of rage, a day of protest in London, the words they hear you say are not the words you say on Radio 4. They're the words you say to the Morning Star. Not legitimate. Not got the right to govern. You say that you're nothing to do with these protesters, but you're egging them on, aren't you?
Well, Nick, I made a speech at the Bakers Union last Monday, actually before Grenfell, remember, as well. It's an important point to make. about a resolution that came forward calling upon the TUC to organise a demonstration against this government. The People's Assembly have organised a demonstration on Saturday week, and I'm supporting that. And I said we need to get as many people out there as possible.
I said
there's 6 million trade unions out there. I'd like to see a million on the street, because I believe you have the legitimate right to demonstrate and protest, but it has to be peaceful, and you have the right, therefore, to change government policy and change government as a result of that.
Of course, protest is perfectly legitimate, but what people want to know is when people are taking Martin's Day of Rage today, so-called, should they be able to say, the shadow chancellor, one of the key guys in the next government, potentially, he tells me this is an unconstitutional, I quote you, undemocratic, illegitimate government with no right to govern.
I believe that they've forfeited the right to govern because, one, they're bringing forward a programme which is not based upon a manifesto. They've junked their own manifesto. They're doing deals with the DUP in secret, behind closed doors, and they haven't got a majority.
So he's up there on the radio saying this government is unconstitutional, illegitimate. Now, he's also very careful to say, well, they must be peaceful. At least he's careful to say that now, once he's much more in the public eye. But then he's also at the same time saying, well, the government's illegitimate. Well, what's that telling people to do? What do you do to an illegitimate government, an unconstitutional government? Well, if it's illegitimate, they have no authority to tell you what to do, to collect taxes. I mean, by calling the government illegitimate, you're basically inciting rebellion against it. Now, in the past, despite what he said there about protests must be peaceful, in the past he's praised violent protesters as, quote, the best of our movement. Here's also just a few of some of his earlier comments on this kind of thing.
The whole point of many of our movements now is to recognise parliamentary democracy doesn't work for us. Elections aren't working for us. We're going to this next general election, and yes, we'll seek to campaign, we'll seek to get people in power who may seek to represent us, but what's happening is elected dictatorships. Democracy is about taking control of your own community, and that means industrial action combined with direct action. We used to call it insurrection, now we're polite and say it's direct action. Let's get back to calling it what it is. It's insurrection. We want to bring this government down by whatever means we can.
We want to bring this government down by any means we can. He calls for insurrection. He calls for smashing the system. And so that's exactly what we see with this day of rage. It's from that same movement. And of course, there's plenty of other people involved. Some have talked about how they want to emulate the riots in 2011, where that's when mobs just went on this 5 days of looting spree, where the police every evening just completely lost control of whole chunks of London, and that was theoretically in response to the police shooting a gangster, Mark Duggan. But really, it was just people saw a breakdown of law and order and took an opportunity to go out and smash shops and grab whatever they wanted. One protester interviewed about this said he wanted nothing short of a revolution. And that's what these people are in so many cases, Marxist revolutionaries. And a lot of these leaders of these protests are really from the radical left. One, for example, is Mohamed Tansnin Akuji, and he specializes as a lawyer in representing Muslim terrorists or Muslims accused of terrorist offenses. And he's in the past, he said things like, I bet you some Tories look at the video of Grenfell Tower burning down and see a solution to benefits claims. Sick people. So he's telling people, the Conservative government, they like to see poor people burning to their deaths. That's what he tells people. Another leader is Mustafa Al-Mansur, no relation, I assume, to our producer today, Jonathan Mansur. He has ties to the radical Finsbury Park Mosque that's been in the news a fair bit after that attack there. But he was a spokesman for the mosque there. He was once arrested on suspicion of terrorist offences, though he was later released and not charged. Here's one of the lawyers, the leaders, Karen Doyle, of this movement for justice by any means necessary. And she's asked on the radio to condemn violence and call for this to be purely a peaceful protest. And here's how she responds to that.
Actually, right now, shout out to people who are going to plan to go on that day of rage protest, that this protest should be peaceful and that you will absolutely disassociate yourself from anybody who acts in a violent way in any way towards other people or towards property in this city.
I will say that we are going to take our demands and our anger to Parliament. We are going to march from Shepherd's Bush Green to Parliament, and we are going to have people speak, and we are going to organise, and we are going to organise beyond today. And you know what?
And nothing about violence. That you don't. You. I've given you an opportunity to say we. This
what
is a no, Karen.
Violence.
No, so no. This is not how interviews work. I've asked you. Will you take this opportunity to tell people this is a peaceful protest and to disassociate your organisation, Movement for Justice, from any violence towards property or person? Will you do that or won't you?
We are not intending.
Will you call on people going on this protest today in an hour or so's time to insist that they act peacefully towards persons and property? Will you or will you not do that?
I'm not going to buy into the rubbish that the press are printing.
I'm not asking you to buy into anything. If the media are lying, Karen, if we're lying about this being a violent protest, you can tell me right now this is a peaceful protest. And this isn't a peaceful protest. You want there to be destruction of property and risk to life and limb, possibly for police officers and others in this day of rage.
We absolutely do not. We absolutely do not. And if you came along, you'd see that. So, you know,
I wouldn't risk coming along.
You're massively underestimating and buying into a whole bunch of racist stereotypes this community. Yes, racist.
We've got racist now. Where did that come from?
When you've got Tory councillors saying about Black, Asian, and immigrant protesters, hang them high, hang them up. That's racist.
I love that you jumped to the R word there, Karen. Karen, I'm going to give you one more opportunity. Will you call on the protesters, the Day of Rage protest, to be peaceful? And will you disassociate yourself and your organisation from anyone who causes violence towards personal property? Yes or no?
I'm going to tell people, come down to this protest and see for yourself.
Third time, Karen Doyle, you chose not to do it. That you stand on your own words. Thank you very much.
So it's a movement that doesn't mind violence, that refused there repeatedly to condemn violence. Because that's partly the whole point of, it's in the name, Movement for Justice by any means necessary. That's what's involved in insurrection, in smashing the system. We saw this from the left in the 1970s when the trade union movement was violent. You know, there were violence in their strikes and their opposition to Margaret Thatcher. It's part of that. It's an extension of that same movement. Just going back to this Melanie Phillips article from The Times, she writes that it's clear that the hard left thinks it now has the chance to mount a coup, aided and abetted by large sections of the media which have presented Corbyn's election defeat as a victory. They have set out to format insurrection on the streets in order to overturn the result. This strategy was plotted before the Grenfell fire. Now it is enabling those agitators to incite hatred and violence by claiming that the Tories didn't just steal the election but have committed murder. Many naive Labour voters believe Jeremy Corbyn is a nice man. The reality is frighteningly different. A fearsome tragedy is being cynically politicised. Even before all the dead of Grenfell Tower have been retrieved and buried, Labour is unleashing mob rule in their name. Compassion is being hijacked and weaponised in what is nothing short of a planned uprising against democracy itself. And she's exactly right. That's exactly what they've been trying to do. Now, it looked like they have largely failed, perhaps at least on Wednesday. How much of that is due to people not wanting to come out in the hot weather, or whether it's just they didn't have the support behind them, I don't know. Perhaps it might be that in the kind of the run-up to that, the government did do a lot to help people from this tower and you know, maybe they did make some mistakes initially, but it does seem like they've really gone out of their way now to try and make sure that these people do have a home and are taken care of. And perhaps they didn't listen to them quite well enough at first. And then maybe there were some grievances. But anyway, maybe before Wednesday, the step that they did take were enough that some people that were genuinely angry about the tower decided not to come out. But those activists are still there. And every tragedy, everything that upsets the people of Britain, they're going to be there to blame the government and incite rage. We already heard briefly from John McDonnell there that they're planning still a trade union march coming up at the beginning of July. He's trying to get 1 million people to turn out. But every time we see something like this, they're going to be there trying to stir up rebellion. They're going to be there the whole time stirring up resentment to the government. And Mr. Gerald Flory, he warned about exactly this kind of thing in his book Great Again. Just breaking into a quote from here where he's talking about the same kind of emotional-based just stirring of the people when it comes to race relations in America. He writes, it would be overstating it to say there's no racism among America's law enforcement officers, but there are some who are scrutinizing and magnifying this issue for evil purposes. And you're seeing the same thing now with things like the Grenfell Tower over in the UK. And we heard the accusation, if you accuse them of wanting violence, well, that's racist, as you heard from that protest leader in that radio clip. They're using it dishonestly, Mr. Flory writes, to justify or excuse some terrifyingly dangerous behavior. Terrifyingly dangerous behavior. That's some of the same language you saw Melanie Phillips write, talking about this attack. Frighteningly difficult. Frighteningly different. Terrifyingly dangerous behavior. They are stirring up emotion and anger, but none of it is truly intended to solve the problem. And that's a perfect description of what the left are doing after Grenfell Tower. In America Under Attack, the earlier book, Mr. Flory gets to what's really behind a lot of this emotion, a lot of this anger. And this is something Mr. Stephen Flory spoke about on his program last week, I think it was last Friday, called What's Behind the Rise in Left-Wing Violence. And he went over some of these same type of quotes. But in that, Mr. Flory writes, Ephesians 2 and verse 2 calls Satan the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. He is stirring up people's emotions, moods, and attitudes. When people get into a negative emotion, a bad attitude, or a wrong influence, he works on those people even more. He has power to influence those wrong emotions. He has deceived the world. Ephesians 2 verse 2 calls Satan the prince of the power. Oh, we just read that. I must have put a couple of quotes together there. But going on, reading more from America Under Attack, he's stirring up people's emotions, moods, and attitudes. When people get into emotions or bad attitudes or a wrong mood, he works on those people even more. He writes, whenever people are fighting to survive and emotions are flying, the devil is going to exploit that every time. Every time, just like we saw in London. Going back to Great Again, talking about again the race riots that we saw in America recently. He writes, the situation is filled with violence. People are being whipped into a frenzy of hatred and violence. A situation filled with confusion. People are being whipped into a frenzy of hatred and violence. This is something the devil knows how to exploit. He is the God of the world, 2 Corinthians 4:4 says, and he knows how to work on people's emotions. And that's the same kind of thing we're seeing now in Britain. And there's that hardcore now of very angry people, and they're looking to stir more people against the government. And that's a very dangerous, dangerous trend. We'll take a quick break now and we'll come back and look at a potentially very significant news story that's not really getting much coverage right now.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. In the summer of 1926, Herbert W. Armstrong asked himself, "Who am I? What am I? Why am I?" He tried to reason out the answer, but he couldn't. It was a mystery. Not long after that, he was confronted with a mind-disturbing challenge on the theory of evolution and the question of Sunday observance. After many months of virtually night and day intensive study, the answers were revealed with proof that was positive and absolute. These answers and many more are thoroughly explained in Mystery of the Ages, which is available to you at no cost or obligation. Time has proven Mystery of the Ages to be the most important book written in nearly 1,900 years. This world's humanity has been blinded to who, what, and why man is, how man appeared on Earth. Man has been mystified by his inability to solve his problems or find answers to the perplexing questions of mankind and the world he inhabits. All these mysteries were long ago revealed by the one supreme authority of all knowledge, but in a coded message, not allowed to be revealed and decoded until our time. In Mystery of the Ages, these great mysteries of life are thoroughly explained in vivid detail. Request your free copy of Mystery of the Ages today. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. And I want to talk now about a separate, very important new story. Ever since I first started working in the news bureau over at the Trumpet, I've always been really fascinated by pipeline politics. I think it's just really interesting the way these relatively tiny strings of pipelines can just play such a huge role in world events. I think it was shortly after I started working there that we saw this in Georgia in 2008, where Georgia is one of the few locations where oil could pass from Central Asia on towards Turkey and then Europe without going through Russian influence. And so then after that invasion, well, Russia had put themselves in a position where they had troops anchored firmly to the south of that Caucasus mountain range and could cut that pipeline anytime they wanted. It meant that there was no longer such an independent route there. And so it's just been really fascinating to see how these little threads change world events or influence world events. And in recent times, Germany has been a key partner in this pipeline politics for Russia. And it's a very interesting partnership to watch. Germany is playing a very subtle game here. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Germany was one of the biggest supporters of sanctions for Russia, at least in terms of keeping the European Union together and united in sanctioning Russia. I think German Chancellor Angela Merkel, she's pretty much single-handedly held European sanctions on Russia together. She's been one of the most outspoken supporters for these sanctions at home in Germany and abroad. But at the same time, Germany has been resolutely moving forward on a crucial pipeline project with Russia. It's called the Nord Stream pipeline. They already have one natural gas pipeline traveling from Russia under the Baltic Sea to Germany. And they've recently begun work on a second, Nord Stream 2. And so all throughout this time, they were even negotiating and starting work on this pipeline. They've had sanctions on Russia in other ways, but they've kept this pipeline going. They have, even the sanctions were kind of carefully crafted so that they wouldn't apply to this pipeline. I think they managed to do it so that EU laws and things only apply to pipelines on EU soil, whereas this goes under the sea and is exclusively an undersea pipeline and therefore exempt. They've really twisted the arms of various officials in the European Union. It's kind of a study in how Germany controls the European Union to make sure that no EU officials block this pipeline. And so what really is going on here? Well, it's a fascinating alliance between Germany and Russia. In the past, Russia has used its control of gas, especially flowing into Central and Eastern Europe, to just blackmail this region. We saw this most extremely in 2006 and then to a certain extent in the winter of 2008, 2009 and 2015, when they would cut off gas to Ukraine in the middle of winter until Ukraine did what Russia wanted. And so much of Ukraine's electricity generation and heating and all of this is dependent upon natural gas, and they get almost all of that from Russia. They're trying to change that recently by re-engineering pipelines so that they can flow backwards and so that they can get oil or gas pumped in from or pumped east from Western and Central Europe back into Ukraine. But still, they're just terribly dependent on Russia. And so Russia has used that as a real tool of coercion, and they've used that as a major part of getting Ukraine or trying to get Ukraine to do what they want over the years. And they also used it more subtly and as less of a blunt instrument. You can look all across Europe, and the better relationship you have with Russia, the cheaper your gas is. The cheaper your, and then you know, the cheaper you pay for natural gas, well, the cheaper your electricity price is, the cheaper heating for your citizens, the more disposable income they have, the better your economy, the more popular your government. So this gives them a lot of leverage. That's a very powerful reason for your government to try and get on well with Russia. It's going to really help your economy out. Now, the downside for Russia when it comes to completely severing natural gas supplies like they did to Ukraine is that Western Europe gets a lot of their gas through Eastern Europe. So if they cut off gas to Ukraine, well, they're not just cutting off gas to Ukraine, they're cutting off gas or a lot of gas to places like Austria, Italy, Switzerland. I haven't checked exactly who's downstream of the Ukraine pipeline, but it starts hitting all these other countries, and those other countries all start getting very annoyed with Russia. They start piling on the pressure for Russia to end the sanctions. Probably even worse for Russia, Russia loses all of that revenue that they would have been getting from those downstream countries buying gas. And so the new Nord Stream pipelines are a partnership with Germany to solve that problem and make Russia's energy weapon much more potent and much more usable. Now they've got one pipeline in place, and soon when they've got this second pipeline especially, they'll be able to cut off gas to, say, Ukraine or to Poland or any nation that they want in Eastern Europe, and then keep sending the rest of Western Europe gas via Germany. So they'll be able to target these cutoffs much more precisely. It becomes a precision tool, a precision weapon, rather than a blunt instrument. And makes it so it's much more usable now, once they've got that all in place. Well, what does Germany get out of it? Well, they get this, you know, they get cheap gas, and they get this economic relationship with Russia for one. For another, then they get to become an energy hub for Western Europe. Back in 2007, when this pipeline first kind of got underway, Mr. Morley wrote that German strategists realize that once the pipeline is complete, they will hold the same gas supply trump card over downstream countries that Russia holds over many Eastern European countries. The importance of the Ukraine and other Eastern European countries to Western Europe's energy conduits will decline in proportion to Germany's increase. Now, the Poles, for example, you know, they see this and see how it's a cooperation between Russia and Germany where they both benefit greatly in power. And so the Poles have started calling this Nord Stream 2 pipeline the Molotov-Ribbentrop 2 pipeline, referencing that infamous pact where Russia and Germany divided Eastern Europe up between them in World War II. In the Telegraph this morning, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard wrote, "What the pipeline does is to erode Ukraine's $2 billion revenue from pipeline fees and to leave the country vulnerable to a Gazprom squeeze. It stops Ukraine transporting gas to Slovakia and then buying it back at EU prices to escape punitive tariffs. It enables Russia to play a divide-and-rule game that splits the EU and that sweetens Germany with preferential pricing. It really is a bizarre 1939-style pact." A 1939-style pact. That's what this gas pipeline is here, increasing both Germany and Russia's power over parts of Europe. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard writes that what is strange is that Berlin seems determined to press ahead with this divisive undertaking when 8 East European states have protested bitterly and Poland is resorting to every legal challenge to block it. The saga is a raw example of how Berlin captures the EU machinery. Brussels set aside EU law on Nord Stream, yet enforced it on other pipelines such as Yamal and South Stream. Solidarity and the rule of law in the EU only applies when the Kanzleramt chooses. It only applies rule of law and solidarity in Europe. It only applies when Germany wants it to. So all very interesting and important, but why is this in the news? Well, the US is now starting to get involved. It looks like it might be effectively about to throw down the gauntlet and say to Germany, whose side are you really on? Russia's or ours? And Germany doesn't really want to openly choose a side yet. I think they want to benefit from a relationship with both. And I think that's why they've been so firm on the other sanctions on Russia. They don't really want to alienate Poland and Eastern Europe too much from them. They want to keep them as part of the European Union, etc. And so they've kept these sanctions in other ways on Russia as a way to try and keep these nations on side. it also gives them a bit of a stick. You know, if you start pushing us too hard, then, well, we'll get Europe, we'll allow the EU to get rid of the rest of its sanctions on Russia. So in a way, I think they're trying to have their cake and eat it, have this relationship, this close relationship with Russia and with the West and with America. But anyway, last week, the U.S. The U.S. Senate passed a bill that would put new sanctions on Russia. And they voted for that 98-2, an overwhelming majority. Congress, it looks like, has blocked that for now. But their disagreement isn't really over the substance of what's in the bill. Instead, they're saying that it's a revenue bill and that revenue bills must originate in the House, not the Senate. Anyway, it seems like something that they'll be able to sort out eventually, even if the House ends up proposing a new bill. But if Congress does approve a bill and it's the same kind of majority as the Senate, well, then that would be veto-proof. President Trump would not be able to veto it. Now, the main thrust of this bill stops Western companies helping Russia with Western technology to develop Arctic or shale gas and oil reserves, thus kind of limiting Russia's ability to generate more energy in the future. But the more immediate drama here comes from another clause in this bill. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard writes, "The new twist is authority for the U.S. Treasury to sanction Western companies colluding with the Kremlin in Nord Stream 2. So Russia, America could use this to try and shut down or to stop construction of Germany's Nord Stream 2 pipeline, something that Germany has fought very hard in the past to prevent. This clause is not mandatory," it writes. "The White House could ignore it. Yet President Donald Trump may have little choice if the Mueller probe into Russian subversion throws up anything serious. The five big companies that signed up to the $9.5 billion costs of Nord Stream 2, and he lists some of them, Uniper and Wintershall from Germany, Austria's OMV, Engie in France, and Shell, all have operations in Russia or aim to have or have pipeline contracts with Gazprom. So America's could really start cracking down on these European countries that do business mostly on Germany's behalf with Russia, that are part of this Molotov-Ribbentrop 2 pipeline. And you could see these major, major German industrial and oil giants facing sanctions from the United States." Ambrose Evans-Pritchard writes that they could defy a Washington ban. "This would be suicidal. They would discover that it is almost impossible for a multinational to operate if it falls foul of an elite treasury cell adept at strangulation." Juan Zaret, ex-head of this outfit, describes the method as a boa constructor's lethal embrace. It works through hegemonic control of the dollarized global banking system. He says that it's a new kind of war, like a creeping financial insurgency intended to constrict our enemy's financial lifeblood, unprecedented in its reach and effectiveness. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, he writes, "Once the U.S. Treasury invokes this scarlet letter under Section 311 of the U.S. Patriot Act, you are radioactive. Defy that if you dare." Germany and Austria are livid, he writes. "We cannot accept the threat of sanctions against European countries that want to contribute to the expansion of European energy supplies," a joint statement says. "Europe's energy supply is a matter for Europe and not the US. And they put all of these exclamation points all over this. Just a final, or for now, final quote from this. He said that there is already talk of retaliatory sanctions, but this would be a German diplomatic Stalingrad. Such a demarche would force Eastern Europe to choose between the EU and Washington. So what we're looking at here really is economic war. If this went ahead, then Germany would basically have to choose between backing down and ending this pact with Russia or engaging in full-scale economic warfare with the United States. America would marshal the full strength and power of the dollar-denominated financial system against these German and European gas companies. And if Germany went down this road, then they'd be committed basically to trying to destroy that dollar-denominated system that America was using against them. I think it does, you know, just kind of looking at it, it does seem probably more logical for Germany to back down here if this happens. You kind of think, well, surely Nord Stream 2 isn't worth economic war with the US. But in this climate, I wouldn't be too sure. Maybe they will back down, maybe they won't. Looking at how fast world events have been moving recently, you'd have to say that this kind of economic war is a real possibility. Looking at the anger at the United States that's building in Europe, the amount that people are being stirred up by their leaders, by the press over there against Donald Trump. And then besides this, what sanctions at the same time, they would make Russia very desperate. At the same time that America's putting in place these sanctions, they are working on exporting liquefied natural gas to Europe in more and more substantial numbers. In numbers that by 2020 are starting to get to about half of, well, half of the equivalent of what Russia is sending to Europe coming from the United States. And Ambrose Evans Pritchard writes, this coming U.S. wave of liquefied natural gas threatens checkmate for the Kremlin. Completely, you know, America is directly targeting Russia's energy weapon here, trying to replace Russia, the dependence that all of these countries have on Russia, with American liquefied natural gas. And so this push against Russia, well, that could make Russia very desperate, enough to make for Russia to make Germany some very generous offers if Germany stays on Russia's side over this. More from going back to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he writes that Germany is entering dangerous waters. It has pushed a line that risks undermining American emotional backing for NATO and the European order, and is deepening a line of cleavage within the EU that may have grave consequences. It is doing so at a time when Western Europe has disarmed and offers an open goal for remilitarized Spartan Russia. The collective feeling in Washington is that American democracy has been raped by Kremlin cyber aggression. Now, whether or not that's true, I think the next bit he writes is, a state of political warfare exists between the US and Russia. We know which side Poland is on. Which side is Germany on? They've left that ambiguous. They don't know right now. They've been playing both sides, Russia and America. And this might force them to choose, and people might be very surprised at what they choose. And Ambrose Evans Pritchard isn't the only one talking like this. Politico, they had an article this week where they wrote, as the world's second largest producer of natural gas, they go over some of the things that we've talked about the pipeline the leverage, the power they have because of these pipelines. They write that the success of Nord Stream 2, however, there is a reminder that security depends on more than military strength and a healthy media environment. The pipeline is a naked Russian attempt to divide and conquer Europe. But it's especially a Russian attempt to divide Europe from America. And so which side is Germany on? And really, Germany's always faced this choice. At the center of Europe, they can radically tip the whole global balance of power either way. Writing during the latter half of the Cold War, Hans Morgenthau, in his book Politics Among Nations, he talked about how the nations of Europe are ambivalent towards the United States, whose support they need but resent. And you certainly see that resentment now. He talked about how if the US withdrew, then these countries may perceive themselves as having been abandoned by the United States and having to face the Soviet Union alone, unchallenged in its military power. And he writes that this would force the nations of Europe to accommodate themselves with Russia. If Germany does this, Morgenthau writes that it would signify a drastic change in the distribution of world power. He says that for Germany, there are rational arguments in support of an Eastern orientation. And that's what we could be seeing as America moves out of Europe, as it pulls back from NATO. Germany may well be deciding that Washington is far and Moscow is near, as the saying in a lot of Eastern Europe. Deciding, well, look, at the moment, we cannot stand up to Russia alone. Therefore, we actually need to put our bets on Russia, on an accommodation with Russia, on siding with them. And they've done this kind of thing in the past. Between 1772 and 1775, Prussia, that kind of precursor to modern Germany, Prussia, Austria, and Russia divided Poland between them. Then they had... they developed this really close relationship with Russia back then. I think one of my favorite anecdotes from War and Peace is one Russian general, and I think this was based on an actual conversation. He was so annoyed by the commanding role that Germans played in the Russian army that he asked the emperor if he could be promoted to the rank of German. He had a strong alliance with them back then. Then, you know, Otto von Bismarck tried to stay on Russia's good side. He said the secret of politics is to make a good treaty with Russia. Germany rejected that in World War I, and it went very badly wrong for them. And then, well, after World War I, they signed the Rapallo Treaty with Russia that really helped them rebuild. And then they divided Poland and Eastern Europe between them in the Hitler-Stalin Pact, or the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So a lot of history there, but also a lot of prophecy. There are a lot of powerful shared interests here. And you know, the trumpet, because of some of these prophecies, some of this history, the trumpeters long forecast a new alliance between these two countries. In 1962, the Plain Truth wrote that once a German-dominated Europe is fully established, Germany will be ready to negotiate and bargain with Russia and behind the backs of the Western allies if necessary. And really, that's exactly what we're seeing with Nord Stream 2, bargaining behind the backs of the allies. And whether that's cut short by American sanctions or whether Germany's forced to double down remains to be seen. But they're there making deals with Russia. This same article writes that when a Russia-German deal is made, you can be sure that the doom of the United States and Great Britain is on the horizon. Now, that may sound far-fetched, but there's many scholars in the field of international relations that make the same kind of warning. We read about Morgenthaler, about how such a deal would be a drastic change in the distribution of world power. Nicholas Spykman, a 1940s professor of international relations, and again, a very influential thinker on international relations, he wrote that the lack of a unified power in Europe or East Asia is an absolute prerequisite to the independence of the New World and the preservation of the power system of the United States. The United States must recognize once again and permanently that the power constellation in Europe and Asia is of everlasting concern to her, both in times of war and in times of peace. So he's warning the United States can only be powerful and independent if you don't have this kind of German-Russian alliance, if you don't have unity within Europe and East Asia. It threatens America's survival here. Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Furrow, he's made the same kind of warning in Russia and China and Prophecy. He wrote, look at history. Every time competition between Russia and Germany heats up, they form a deal with one another just before going to war. And as he points out there, it's not necessarily a great harmonious relationship because they're best buddies and pals forever. It's an alliance of convenience because of overlapping common interests. And typically the two still end up going to war together again shortly afterwards. But these wars, they've all engulfed the world and turned these allies of convenience against each other in devastating ways. And so we're seeing more and more strong signs with this thing, like this pipeline, like Nord Stream 2, that they're talking, that they're dealing. And we're seeing more and more pressure on these two powers to start to work together. So Germany could choose Russia over the United States potentially very soon. They could be forced to make that choice very soon. So this American sanctions works their way through the House, through the Senate, it'll be something that's very important, very interesting to keep watching. Now, while we're talking of Russia, our main Asian man, Jeremiah Jacques, he'll be on this show tomorrow. I have no idea what he's planning on talking about, and hopefully I haven't just stolen his entire subject. He is always very interesting, very entertaining to listen to, so I'd really encourage you to tune in then. I'll be back on Monday. We've got lots of other programs coming up on as well over the next few days. We've got our Trumpet Hour Week in Review program tomorrow. If you have any comments, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. You can email me if you like at richardpalmer@thetrumpet.com. And tune in tomorrow for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on KPCG 101.3 FM.